open in a word of prayer. We just thank you, Father. We thank you for this time. Thank you for your word and the lessons we can glean from it. We think of all the ministries that are taking place here tonight, just that you'd be at work in lives, that your spirit would move and enlighten people to the truth of your word as it's proclaimed. And we pray this in your son's name. Amen. Okay. We have entered a new era. Now remember, 1 and 2 Samuel were one scroll. Okay, so this is one history. And yet, throughout this scroll, there's different phases, different people who take center stage. It's quite interesting. In the chapters that we're going to be looking at, chapters 2 through 5, we're not going to look at all of them tonight, but in these sections, it's amazing how the second in command, Joab, and also Abner, are very key in these chapters. This is a new phase of David's life. He is no longer leading the life of abandoned on the run from Saul. And so he is able to settle down and start consolidating his kingdom. This begins with Judah, but then eventually after 7.5 years, he's able to bring Israel under his authority as well. And it's very instructive how this man of God does this. I think that's very important to understand how he goes about this. He is the shepherd of Israel, and we see him very gently dealing with a group of individuals. Well, as I say in the title there, they initially rebel against him being king and separate themselves. There's a divided kingdom the first 7.5 years that David reigns. We see in 2 Samuel, the reference here, in 2 Samuel, I didn't get in there. Okay. Well, you could see it. We're not too far from there. 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 2. Note what is said there previously. This is Israel addressing David. Previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over them. So he is definitely the shepherd of Israel. Here we have an Old Testament example of a shepherd. Slightly different from a New Testament example, but I think there's definitely principles that we can apply. And as we think about David, he is the preeminent shepherd of Israel. He's the standard by which all subsequent shepherds were measured. We see in 2 Kings this statement concerning him. Now it came about that Hezekiah, so this is several centuries later, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. He did right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. So here we are. David is the long-standing measuring rod for all the kings that would come after him. We see that some fell short. There was one that measured up, Hezekiah, but then we have Jeroboam. You have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and who followed me with all his heart, to do only that which was right in my sight. So they either measured up or they fell short. But David was the measuring rod for the shepherds, the leaders of Israel. And when we look here, these were kind of devoid of the exception, okay? But we do see also the exception named in Scripture. Because David did what was right in the sight of the Lord and had not turned aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite. We're going to see different instances where David falls short of the biblical standard, even for the kings in that era. But again, the overarching testimony concerning his life is that he is exemplary, and he is to be modeled and so forth, as far as that he's a godly man. He's a godly man after God's own heart. Well, again, in David, we see an excellent example of an Old Testament shepherd. There are principles for New Testament shepherding as well. Most specifically that I see in these opening chapters is this graciousness that he has towards his subjects who aren't really ready to submit to him. They're still wanting the old choice, Saul, and aren't ready to embrace the new choice. And we also see in David that there are pitfalls concerning success and power, okay? There are pitfalls here, and so it's instructive that way. There's the danger of immorality, there's the danger of nepotism, and there's the danger of pride. David really embodies all three of these at some point of his life. When I use that word nepotism, what am I talking about? Family? Okay, what about family? Okay, yeah. Favoritism towards your family, because they're your family, not necessarily because of the merits that they possess, or the qualities, or the, you know, character, or whatever. It's not something that is objective or, you know, praiseworthy. Rather, it's just because they are family that you are demonstrating favoritism. And David does that and it comes back to haunt him and cause problems there. But chapter 2, Israel rebels against the Lord's anointed, and David is very gracious in this, in bringing them in. We see four individuals that are key players here. First is Abner, okay? Abner is a key player. He is a second in command in Israel, okay? The kingdom of Saul, you might say. He is a self-seeking second in command, and he's kind of the brains and the brawn behind the kingdom in the north. Second is Ishbosheth. This is the pawn, and he is the descendant of Saul. And so in order to have this kingdom, to have a divine right and a divine claim to a ruler, he is elevated to king, but he wasn't God's choice. David was God's choice. So this is, again, naming him king is an act of rebellion. Joab is the second command under David, and he also is a self-seeker. Okay, we got two self-seekers here that are fighting it out in these chapters. And he is definitely a man of action. And he gets what he wants, and he gets it by force. Okay, that's his way. And in contrast to him is his leader, his head, and that's David. And there's tensions between these two throughout their relationship. David is seeking the Lord's will. And he is an example of patient, diplomatic, you know, bringing people along and bringing people in under God's timing, God's way. And so he waits upon the Lord. Joab's more of the forceful type. He's ready to force it. All right, any questions or thoughts before we get into this section? We're just going to look at chapter 2 today. Okay. Who would like to read for us verses 1 through 3? Yes, Anita. Okay, thank you. David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to the cities of Judah?" In one way, this is a no-brainer. Why is it a no-brainer in light of what we've seen? Okay, that's one reason. That's good. Any others? Yes. Okay, yeah, leaving there was a bad idea. Yeah, leaving there to go to Philistia ended up being a bad choice, so it just makes sense. We need to go back. He's in Philistia. Judah would be a far better place to be than where he's at presently. So here he is. Even though this decision is a no-brainer, he's seeking the Lord. What does it say if a man is seeking the Lord even when the choice is obvious? Okay. Wisdom. Why? Okay, yeah, he's very humble at this point. I mean, even the most obvious of decisions, perhaps, he's still seeking the Lord in these things. This is not what we saw him doing earlier when he went down to Philistia, okay? And so he's gun-shy now. He's very humble. He realizes that he blew it big time, and he doesn't want to do this again. And who knows? I mean, maybe the Lord would say, you know, don't go up to Hebron. Go up to, you know, Gibeah or wherever and establish the kingdom there. I mean, any number of decisions could have come down from the Lord. The obvious choice isn't always God's choice. So it was a good, humble thing that he did here. He's instructed to go to Hebron by the Lord. And this is his last stop on this map. You can see he's been spending most of his time down in Ziklag. Well, let's see, the last, 16 months he had been in Ziklag, a year and 4 months. And then he comes over here, and he's at Hebron now. And that's where he's going to reign over Judah for the next 7.5 years. Any questions or thoughts before we continue? Okay. Who would like to read verses 4-7? Yes, Jeff.
Then the men of Judah came and served. They anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, the men of Jabesh Gilead were the ones who buried Saul. And David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to them, you are blessed of the Lord, for you have shown this kindness to your Lord Saul and have buried him. And now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you. I also will repay you this kindness because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strengthened and valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them.
Okay, thank you. Now David has already been anointed king by the Lord. Samuel carried that out. But now we see him being anointed in this passage as well. What is this anointing about? What's that? Oh, okay. You're on to something. Yeah, it is a statement, but a statement by whom? Judah. Yeah. This time it's a statement by Judah. In other words, we're getting on the same page with the Lord. The Lord has already anointed him king. Now we're going to anoint him king over Judah. Okay. So they were just acknowledging the Lord's decision through this act. David hears of the men of Jabesh-Gilead on this occasion and commends them, verses 5 and 6. May you be blessed of the Lord, because you have shown this kindness. That's that word hesed that I've talked about in the past. You have shown this loving kindness to Saul, your Lord. That word hesed is the idea of covenant loyalty, okay, in spite of what the person is, okay. He was the Lord's anointed, and they honored him as such. They honored him as such despite who he was, and he says, and have buried him, verse 6. Now may the Lord show loving kindness, there's the same word, and truth to you. And that idea of truth could be translated faithfulness. Okay, may he show you loving kindness and faithfulness to you as well. Now, what does David's commendation morph into as he continues on after that? He commends them to, okay, that's a good word. It was an invitation, okay, in inviting them to come back, or to come under, I should say, to come under his leadership as the Lord's anointed. He says, I also will show this goodness to you, okay? He's talking about their relationship with him at this point. Verse 7, now therefore, let your hands be strong and valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. This is David being diplomatic, okay? Now, as the Lord's anointed, how could he have spoken to them? Yeah, I'm drafting a decree, okay? And I order you to submit to me as king. And yet, that's not what he does here. Now, in theory, could he not have done that? Yeah, he was the Lord's anointed. He was the highest authority in the land. And yet, that is not how he approaches this. He approaches it very humbly. He appeals to them, okay? He encourages them. He commends them. He's not being insincere either. He's just being diplomatic. That's important to point out here as well. Anyone else? Questions or thoughts? Okay. Who would like to read verses 8-11? Yes. Mom.
But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishmael, the son of Saul, and brought him over to the enemy. He gave him the king of Gilead over the Asherites, over Jezreel, and he used him over Ephraim, and over the Judah, and he met all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 4 years old, and he was king of Israel. He was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The time that David was king of Israel,
Thank you. Why would Abner make such a move? There's a couple things I could think of, but you know, what would be one reason that Abner would make this move? Okay, yeah. This is what Saul warned about earlier, right? He said, Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjamites, will the son of Jesse also give all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds?" He points this out. You're not going to go as far with David as you did with me. Now, what's ironic here is that statement true? Actually, with David, okay, he is prepared to receive them and to promote them and so forth. He's ready to reconcile the two nations. He's being very diplomatic, and much to Joab's distress, I mean, Joab is constantly in danger of losing his spot, okay? David wants to move him along, but Joab makes sure that he kills off everybody who might just take his place. Joab is the problem here. David's not the problem. David, as a godly man, he's seeing that this is Israel, okay? And he wants a united kingdom because that's God's desire. He wants a united kingdom as well. Again, a man after God's own heart. He wasn't going to punish them just because they served Saul and even helped chase David and so forth. So let's see here. As far as a map, we're really distorted there. That's okay. I guess you get the idea. It's almost like we're looking at an angle here. It's three-dimensional. This was the extent of Saul's kingdom. And you can see here this striped area in the middle. This is where the Philistines controlled for a time. They had taken this region in their conquest away from Israel, okay? So Ishbosheth, he reigns just a very small segment. This green striped area is where he reigned. And as you can see, they had to reclaim this area from the Philistines. We're going to talk about that in a minute, what that would have probably entailed and how that works into the chronology here. But you can see a very small segment that he ultimately ends up reigning. Saul's son was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. Now, it's interesting because in the same statement or the same area here, it's named that David reigned for 7.5 years. And the question becomes, well, why is there a discrepancy here? It's somewhat easy to resolve. First of all, there's nothing to say that Ishbosheth was named instantly as soon as Saul died to be king. Presumably there was some fighting going on. Perhaps Abner was preoccupied trying to beat back the Philistines before they could start consolidating a kingdom under Ishbosheth. Then we also think too that it's possible that there was a lengthy delay after the death of Ishbosheth. It could have been years before Israel said, okay, we'll come and submit to David. They could have held out after the death of Ishbosheth as well. So those two things, there could be time gaps, both before and after the 2 years that would equal or add up to the 7.5 years. Any questions or thoughts? Okay, who would like to read for us verses 12 through 17? Yes, Kurt. Okay, thank you. So we have this divided kingdom. again, you know, perhaps year four, year five, somewhere in there, we have this divided kingdom. You have Judah in the south, reigned from Hebron with David. You have Mahanaim over here. That's the capital of the north. And here, where are they meeting? Gibeon, right in the middle. So, you know, about midway, okay, on the border is where they're meeting. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, this is the first mention of Joab. He hasn't been named prior to this. We've heard of his brother Abishai. What did Abishai do that was noteworthy? Anybody remember Abishai? He volunteered. The first time he snuck into the camp, Abishai went with him. Okay, he volunteered for that position. So we have talked about Job in the past because of his relationship to Abishai, but prominent in this chapter will be Asahel. Asahel was their the third child, presumably, the youngest. And he first appears, Joab first appears at the head of the army opposite Abner. He won't hold this position permanently, and he's always having to fight people off, but at this time he is there. Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." Have we seen this before? Have the young men arise and hold a contest before us. Have we seen this in a battle before? David and Goliath, yeah. This is representative warfare. Okay, you put forth your representatives, I'll put forth mine. And the advantage, of course, is why do we all have to get involved here? Why do we all have to die? Let's put forward these 12. Each one of them, ask this, first of all. Why would someone make such a suggestion? It came from Abner, mind you. Why would somebody make such a suggestion? Okay, yeah. On that smaller scale, they think they have an advantage. And so he makes this suggestion. Clearly, with David and Goliath, you know, it was obvious. They thought they had the advantage with this individual who could beat him. Why do we all have to risk our lives? It would appear to be the same instance, and it proves to be true. Abner's forces are no match for David's forces. So maybe if we have a smaller contest, 12 guys could do well, but, you know, we don't feel like we could take him on. The 12 face each other. Each of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. How did it work out? It was a draw. It was a stalemate. It didn't really resolve anything. Okay, you couldn't declare a clear winner and say, winner goes to Abner and his men. There was no resolution here, so the battle ensues. Okay, the battle ensues. Now, Helkath Hazurim, okay, this means the field of the dagger. So presumably they went against each other. They had a small two-edged sword that they were using against one another, and it was forever renamed because of this occasion. That day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Okay, well, we're going to get into some of the details of the battle. Any questions through verse 17? Yes. Yes. Anyone else? Okay. Who would like to read verses 18 through 23? No one. Janet. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Why would Asahel pursue Abner so strongly? What? He's the prize. Yeah, I think they pretty well knew that Abner was the mastermind here. Without Abner, it would fall apart pretty quickly. So this is expedient. I mean, this is the wisest move to make on the battlefield. Aim for Abner. He's the brains here. Ishbosheth won't be able to keep it together if Abner dies. Now, the dynamic here between Asahel and Abner, Asahel could catch Abner. Okay, he was fast. But Abner seems to be aware that Asahel would not be able to defeat him in hand-to-hand combat. Okay, he's aware that he's the more experienced warrior here, and you might be able to catch me, you young kid. But you know, I'm gonna beat you. I'm gonna whip you when you get your hands on me. He seems genuinely reluctant to kill Asahel. Why? Okay, he has to face his brother Joab. And it's interesting. He says, how then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? That's kind of interesting. It shows you that this is a civil war. I mean, it shows you that there were relationships and there was camaraderie that had happened in the past. And now they're looking at this and saying, you know what? I just couldn't even look your brother in the face if I ended up doing this to you. He says to him, turn to your right or to your left. And take hold of one of the young men for yourself, and take for yourself his spoil. How would you feel hearing that as one of his soldiers? Get that guy right over there. I genuinely think he wasn't concerned in the sense that Asahel would get the better of him, okay? I think he knew in his genuine statement that he did not want to have to look his brother in the eye if he were to kill him. How did Abner show he was a veteran soldier? Okay. Well, Asahel did, but I'm saying Abner. How did Abner show himself to be the veteran soldier? Okay, yeah. And he uses his own zeal against him. I mean, this guy is so zealous. I mean, he wasn't really thinking about what he was walking into. He gets so close that he's able to do this move on him that, you know, even the butt end of the spear he's able to use against him and use his own zeal, his own speed against him. And this really shows skill, and it shows that he was the veteran soldier here. It made also Asahel partly responsible for his own death. I mean, he was, which would work to his advantage when he has to face Joab. I don't know how much he thought about this, but it definitely says, hey, he ran into my spear. You know, what was I supposed to do about that? that's what I see here. Now, how could Asahel have been a shrewd? How could he have been shrewd with his advantage of speed? Yeah, just wear the old guy out. Just wear him out. And when he's so tired, then you take him out. That could have been what he should have done. You know, would have been as effective, would have ever worked, who knows. But I see there where he just got too close. I mean, he was way too close, and he thought it would work out, and it didn't. Abner was smarter. He was a shrewder soldier than he was. Now, why would all who came to Asahel's corpse stand still? What does that indicate? Okay, honor. Okay. If people, there's other people who died in the battle. They obviously moved on. And there's other instances where people die or kill. Joab kills an individual, Amasa, and they stop as they go by. It speaks to the fact that this was a significant individual. It wasn't just anybody who died on the battlefield here. It was, oh boy, what's Joab going to think about this? And that is an issue, okay? It goes on to be an issue. He was a significant individual, and like Abner, they knew this would be a big deal, okay? Okay, Abner knew it. They know it. And this was Joab and Abishai's brother, and it wasn't just going to go away easily. Any questions or thoughts there? Okay. Who would like to read verses 24 through 28 for us? Yes, Greg. Okay, thank you. So Abner, in retreat, he rallies a segment of his army, and they make a stand on an elevated position. This puts him at an advantage. It's a position where he's able to negotiate a little bit, and that's what we see here. He enters into negotiations. And he says, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers?" So he starts to plead with them on the fact that, yes, we are brethren. This is a civil war. And what are we going to do? Wipe out the whole nation? You know, where's the end? Where does this road end? Now, is there any irony in Abner's words? Why? He started it. Thank you. He initiated the battle. Now he's trying to be the voice of reason. Okay. This is backwards. Again, he's just trying to save his own neck here. Ultimately, Abner will resort to diplomacy to resolve this whole thing. But again, even in that diplomatic approach that he takes, he wants to secure himself in a position of authority. So he is concerned. This is a self-serving reality. It's unfortunate. Here all these individuals die in this battle, and what are they dying for? So that Abner could secure a spot in David's kingdom. Okay. The war, ultimately, he started this battle, and he will bring about his conclusion as well, of sorts. The death of Ishbosheth is what ultimately does it, but again, it starts to unravel once Abner's dead. Okay, well, verse 27, it says, "Joab said, as God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each from following his brother." There's two ways we can understand this, because there's two statements that it could be associated with from Abner, okay? The first one was started, or when the battle started, when he solicited this fight, okay? This contest between these men. And he's saying, in effect, if you had not solicited the fight, they would have continued pursuing until morning. That seems a little peculiar, because Joab calls the battle off now, okay? And it seems to be in light of what he says now, not the fact that he started the fight. The second way you could understand that is this phrase as far as what he spoke of, if you had not just said a word of truce, they would have continued pursuing until morning. That makes more sense, okay, that it's the present word that was spoken here. Joab does immediately call off his men, and it seems to be in light of, or just an act of mercy in light of the plea. It would seem that even Joab didn't want to really kill the Israelites. He didn't want to kill his brethren, which is in his favor. I mean, for all of his scoundrelness, is that a word? Scoundrelness. For all of his, he doesn't want to kill his brethren. And he speaks in terms of the members of his armies as following his brother. The members of his army were following his brother. So he is emphasizing that relationship as well. This wasn't a good thing. And yet, ultimately, who was wrong? Israel or Judah? Yeah, Israel was wrong. I mean, Abner was leading them in rebellion against the Lord's anointed, all to just basically secure himself as in a position of power. Any questions or thoughts through verse 28? Yes. Sometimes, a lot of times, yeah. That isn't it so wonderful that, well, it's becoming less and less, but, you know, the whole theory behind our government is what? Kind of divide up the power, right? Of course, a soldier's glory is what? War. So, yeah, it's good we have a civilian leader. At any rate, verses 29 through 32, who would like to read those? Yes. Okay, thank you. 19 of David's men, 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. So that means 20 men died of David's men. 12 died in the contest, and the remaining 8 died in the subsequent battle. So it was actually to their detriment to engage them in this little contest here. More people died in the contest than they did in the battle, interestingly enough. But clearly, if that's the greatest casualties they inflicted, clearly it was to Abner's advantage to have it that way. But Abner's men, 360 men died. So this becomes the pattern, and that's what it says in chapter 3, verse 1. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. This becomes a pattern that from the very beginning, Israel and rebellion never really has their way, and it just kind of chips away and chips away at their forces, their cause of keeping Saul's kingdom going, and they have to capitulate. They took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. This confirms his significance. No one else has mentioned this way. Here they are. They're in a rush to get back to Hebron. They end up marching all night from Bethlehem to Hebron. They're in a hurry to get back to Hebron to safety, but on the same token, they stopped to bury Asahel in his father's tomb. This was the most significant death out of the 20 that died. Joab most likely did not know about Asahel's death when he blew the trumpet. I just don't think that he would have let Abner escape if he had known that Asahel had died at that time. Especially in light of what happens subsequent to this. And the next opportunity he has, Joab murders Abner for this very thing. Okay. So we see these two seconds in command, and this is really setting the stage. This is setting the stage for the encounter later. There's bad blood between these two men. Of course, Abner wants Joab's position, and he also killed his brother. And so he has two reasons to get rid of him the next time Joab to get rid of Abner the next time he sees him. Any questions or thoughts? Yes. Well, after the fact, he certainly would have. Oh, good question. It obviously became known because he kills him for it, because of his brother. Yeah. Right. Some way he found out. Presumably someone told him, you know, witnessed it or something. Yeah. There were clearly other of Abner's men. Presumably there were other men from Judah that were in pursuit as well. Anyone else? Okay, let's go ahead and take down some prayer requests.